Oh, hello, drum machine. Thanks, drum machine. Hey, welcome to iOS Building Blocks, episode 13. My name is Scott Smith. I'm your host. You can find me on Twitter at ScottSmithDev. Now, today we have a great show, super exciting guest who actually does tons of stuff, but let me just name three of the things. He's currently at RevenueCat, he's the lead maintainer of Fastlane, and he most recently founded a Swift conference here in the United States, and their first one will be in 2023. It's in Chicago, Illinois. It's called Deep Dish Swift. Our guest today is Josh Holtz. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, how's it going?
It's going good. I've had my laptop closed, I think, for the past 2 months because I had a new daughter who was born in September. So I've been kind of out of the programming type of headspace for a while. So it's kind of weird to be at a computer again, but I think I'm going to enjoy this one.
Yeah. Back in your zone. Here we are.
Exactly. Yeah.
Comfort place. Well, cool. Let's start off by hearing a little backstory about you getting into the dev space, how you became a developer and like how that all happened.
So I'm at my parents' house right now. So it actually all happened like one room over is where it all started.
Okay.
I first started getting into development in 2004-ish. It's been some time. My dad is actually a programmer. He's retired now, so he was a programmer. But he started showing me some Java stuff back in like 2004. And then I realized in high school I could take a programming class. So I wasn't really interested in programming at first. I think I wanted to do some sort of like graphic design or something of some sort. But I signed up for the first class, which was Visual Basic. And day one, just fell in love with it. Like I knew that day, like it was for me. So that's way back in the story. So in high school, I did Visual Basic, then HTML, JavaScript, and then Java for a year, and then an independent study in Java because I maxed out all the courses and I just wanted to like keep doing stuff. And then while in high school, I ended up doing, I think I had my own VPS, so I had my own like server where I learned Ubuntu and PHP and MySQL and stuff. So I was doing all that fun server stuff relatively young age, I think. And then from there, I ended up going to Milwaukee School of Engineering for software engineering, which was good. I don't think I used a lot of what I've learned there those days. But it was mainly Java for those 4 years. But on the side, I also did a lot of fun stuff. I learned Ruby in those years, which I still use today quite heavily. And then I also had a four-year internship at Fidelity Information Services doing more Java stuff. So I've had like 8 years of experience in that. Didn't really love enterprise financial systems too much, so I want to try something new. When I graduated college, I ended up going to Rockwell Collins to do like graphic displays that go into like helicopters and airplanes and stuff like that. Some more like low level C kind of stuff. They ended up switching teams after I signed up. And I went to a team that was on the Apache helicopter, but they were in a 4-year testing phase. And there was like team rework, so I didn't have anybody to report to or anything. So I eventually quit after 2 months because it was not the job for me. I wrote 12 lines of code the entire time there, which is not great. But at the same time, me and some of my friends from college were also doing a startup that we got funding for from doing a 24-hour hackathon. It was a tour-based startup where you could, like, as a tour giver, you could build a tour. People who then could use your app to download the tour and kind of it's something that's kind of built into Airbnb right now. But we built this thing back in like 2011. We were young, didn't really do much tourism stuff, so we quickly stopped that. But we still like to build cool stuff. So then we started a software consulting company in 2011. I was the first one to go full time because I YOLO quit my job. When I was had enough full time work, one of my friends did work at night. When he had enough nighttime work, he quit his job and joined me full time. We dominoed into five of us working within like 6 months or so. So I did that then. I did that consulting for 10 years. I specialized in mobile, but did a lot of back-end, front-end, web, whatever kind of projects came our way. Then I finally sold my my part of the company last December, and then Revenue Cat is where I ended up after that, and that's where I am now.
Nice. That's quite the story.
Quite the story.
Yeah, let's talk about Revenue Cat then. Like, so
yeah.
How'd you kind of end up there, and what's it like, and what it, and for listener who might not know about Revenue Cat, give a little spiel on what they are and why they're so awesome.
Yeah, so it is a mobile subscription platform, I think is the shortest way to put it. We offer different SDKs for iOS, Android, Flutter, React Native, Cordova, and Unity. Along with Stripe integration as well. And I basically kind of wrap all of the native payment APIs into ours to make it a lot easier to use. There's a lot that goes into that, but our SDKs do look pretty much the same across all platforms. And then we have a dashboard that has so many awesome charts, graphs, customer support things in there that you can all do. I started using Revenue Cat in my indie apps before I joined. So I was a customer first. So I didn't want to do IAPs or subscriptions or anything because it looked terrible and not fun. So I fell in love with the SDK after three of my apps had it. And then I decided I wanted to join the pain. And that's where I am now. So I still don't know much about IAPs or subscriptions at all because there's just so much there. Our company right now, I think, is about it's 60 people. I think there've been like 10 people joined since I've been on leave. So it's going to be fun to jump back into work end of this month. Yeah. So that's. Oh yeah, so yeah, I joined for originally doing on the SDKs team for iOS, but now I'm on the feature team where it's less about like SDK maintenance and health and that kind of stuff, and more about new things that we add to SDKs. Back end and the front end as well. So I'm on a team that's kind of like cross functional right now.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you see it all over the place. Whenever anybody uses Revenue Cat, they love it. But tell us why. Like, why is it so magical for an iOS developer in particular? Why would it be so cool?
Yeah. So, Apple's IAP and subscription stuff is in a framework called StoreKit. StoreKit, which sometimes when you say it sounds like stork, stork the bird, it, yeah. And I can't stand it. So StoreKit, and StoreKit 1 was kind of, I don't want to talk bad about Apple, but it's kind of a hot mess of a framework. It really wasn't built for all the things that it can that iOS can do today. Like it was mainly built for like single purchases and not really subscriptions and all of that kind of stuff that subscriptions entail, like renewals, billing issues and all that kind of stuff. Like it doesn't make it easy, and it's not only, and you can't really do store kit nicely just on your device either. You have to have a API that handles all of the renewals issues, all that kind of stuff. You want to make things go cross-platform, that makes it even harder. There's a lot of weird edge cases and all this kind of stuff. So if you really want to do store kit stuff yourself, you almost need an entire team to handle it, depending on app size or something like that. Which, if you're a indie iOS developer, you just kind of want to make an app, ship it, have subscriptions in there. You don't want to have to worry about having an API that you have to support with all the new Apple store kit things that technically occur. So Revenue Kit handles all that for you. We're essentially your back end for store kit. So all, and it also works cross platform as well. So if you are an indie developer that does iOS and Android or a cross platform thing, you don't have to worry about doing even more platforms or anything like that. So we take a lot of that work and like scary bits out, and it's really just a few API calls, and boom, you have subscriptions.
Yeah, in-app purchases, subscriptions, like it's just handled in a handful of lines of code, right?
Refunds,
Like,
yeah.
yeah, that's
And
amazing.
yeah, and Apple did release Store Kit 2 a few years ago, which is better, and you can do like own like it does make on-device subscriptions a little bit easier. I actually have a blog post coming out on how to actually make an app using Store Kit 2 directly, which kind of goes against what Revenue Cat does, but we do kind of like, we're not always the right choice for people. So if somebody does want to use Store Kit 2, by all means, go that choice. So I actually have a pretty lengthy blog post that's like a full tutorial on how to use Store Kit 2. Not to necessarily scare people away, but just because it is a good thing to know, and there isn't really like a big detailed document blog post tutorial on how to do it. So like, it's still an option. Some people don't like to have third-party SDKs, which I totally understand. But we are there for the people who don't want to have to learn something.
And well, first, your blog post, tell the listener where they can find that once it does come out.
That will be revenuecat.com/blog. Once I get back to work in end of November slash December, it should go out shortly thereafter. So it'll be tweeted about from me on my Twitter at Josh D. Holtz, and new cat's Twitter as well.
Nice. I do remember when the store kit got updated, right? And everybody was like, "Oh wow, finally there's a store kit update." And Revenue Cat was like, "We're on it." And I remember just thinking, "Oh man, that's so amazing that there's this team dedicated to figuring out exactly how to integrate everything, all the new changes, and you don't have to worry about it." So that's one huge benefit to using Revenue Cat. Like, there's a team dedicated to this. You don't have to worry about it. So I think that's very
Exactly.
cool.
And that was that Store Kit 2 was announced before I joined. So I hopped in at the tail end of that migration. But our SDK does support both Store Kit 1 and Store Kit 2. So our customers can choose for our SDK to use whichever one they want. Right now, it does. I believe it was switched over to default to Store Kit 2. But if for some reason you do want to use Store Kit 1, or you're still forced to use Store Kit 1, or there are some APIs that still require Store Kit 1, like when you're clicking a in-app purchase from the App Store, the only way for that to work is through Store Kit's 1 APIs. So you can't fully do everything with Store Kit 2 right now. So our SDKs do kind of make sure that like users don't have to worry about that. And for some reason, if Store Kit 3 does come out, we'll handle that as quick as we can as well.
Yes.
I just
That's
sure hope it doesn't. I sure hope it doesn't, but
right. And another thing that was really interesting and seriously intriguing about using Revenue Cat is the pricing structure. So right now we're recording this. This is November 2022, but currently, tell us about the pricing structure, because that is one thing that I thought, wow, that's really doable and really amazing. They give you a lot.
I'm also going to just go look at it right now because I
Oh yeah,
have been out of the game. So
I don't expect you
there
to
we
have it
go.
memorized, but
Yeah. So Revenue Cat has actually made $0 from my indie apps, which feels weird because it is so helpful to me. But there are three, four tiers. The basic tier, the free tier, is you get a bunch of stuff for free as long as your monthly tracked revenue is under 10K, which is for an indie app, I feel like that's a lot of dollars. I'd be super happy if my apps made over 10K. But
Yeah.
you get the SDKs for all platforms that handle subscription. You get metrics. You can view customer profiles. You can put your customers into groups that you can do stuff with them, which I don't actually know how I would use that. I'm a terrible app owner. And then community support as well. But if you go for any of the other plans, which there's a starter, which is $8 per month for every $1,000 of revenue tracked. And then there's a pro plan, which is $12 per month for every 1,000 tracked, which I feel like is still fairly reasonably priced. If I make $1,000, I'm probably okay paying $8 on that because you get
Yeah.
charts, which these charts are amazing. You can see, I don't have my Revenue Cat account open right now, but you can see charts that show more than just like how much you made. You can see churn. You can see charts that based upon your Apple ad search stuff. You can kind of see like if your ad searches are actually like doing good for you. You get webhooks, Slack integration, Firebase integration. You can add more collaborators. Collaborators, that's a weird word right now. And then we also, for the pro tier, you get integrations, which there's a handful of those if you do a lot of, I can't even think of them off the top of my head. It's been months, but there's a ton of things there. So, like, for $12 for every 1,000 draft, it seems, to me, it seems worth it.
Oh yeah, totally. And
It
for the
should scale well with your growth.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, for the average developer who has an indie app and they make any money on it, they're so excited. Like, whoa, man, I made like $5. It's like nice, but yeah. So anyway, the point is you get a lot with Revenue Cat for very little, you know. So
For
that's
sure.
very
So
cool.
if I had to do that on my own, I'd be paying for a API instance that I have to maintain, spend my time on. Database upgrades, whatever all of that stuff is, and that's it's not worth my time to work on that for my own apps. So Revenue Cat, it just makes sense.
It does, yeah. You can get up and running just super fast, then just keep moving on with the more fun stuff, like, you know.
My latest app I did, I think it took me 15 minutes to put IAPs into my app. Like I just have it down now where like it's stupid easy now. So it's a very re repeatable steps for any new apps or subscriptions that you want to throw in there.
Right. Yep. Because for anybody who's tried to do it themselves, it can be done. But then you have to just considering all the edge cases and oh, what if this happens and this happens? It's just go with Revenue Cat. That's all there is
I agree, I agree.
to it. Well, that's really cool. One thing that I've always been so curious about how you got into. We're kind of switching gears here. See you
Yeah.
later. See you later, Revenue Cat. Now, it's Fastlane. So,
Yeah.
before we get into how you actually ended up, you know, working on that and becoming the lead maintainer of it, describe to the listener who doesn't know what Fastlane is.
So Fastlane is, I'm going to say, the industry standard mobile automation tool, which is very vague, but also Fastlane, it can do almost anything you want it to. It was originally built for the iOS Apple ecosystem, but now supports any mobile platform. But you can use it to automate your app builds, testing, taking screenshots, framing screenshots, uploading metadata to the App Store, including screenshots and videos, and submitting apps for review, uploading apps to Test Flight, Google Play. There's a whole plugin system, so you can upload your apps to App Center and all the other ones that I can't remember. I have a plugin to upload your apps to AWS S3 if you want to host them there. So that creates like a nice download HTML site for you to use if you don't want to use like App Center or something like that. So you can run it on your local machine. You can run it on a CI. It's installed by default on Circle CI, GitHub. BitRise uses it for everything they do. Microsoft App Center uses it for their stuff. So it pretty much powers a lot of different CI providers and whatnot. So it's kind of a fun and also scary thing to work on.
Yeah, it's a big deal because a lot of people depend on it, and it's got a really interesting backstory too, which maybe a lot, it's been so long since it's been created. I don't know if a lot of people even realize, like, oh, Fastlane, this is what people use. We'll just use it, but they don't realize how cool the backstory is from Felix. I don't even
Yeah.
know how to pronounce his last name. How do you pronounce it?
Felix Krause, I think. Krause? I don't actually know anymore. Shoot. It's been a while. Yeah.
If he's listening, sorry. We your name's Felix.
Sorry,
That sounds
Felix. I
good.
feel like I should totally know this.
Yeah. Anyway, do you remember the? I don't know the details well enough, but I know it was like, in his dorm or something.
Yeah.
Classic programmer starting
Yeah,
something, but
I can give a
yeah.
little high level of that. So, Felix started creating this in October of 2014. Which that seems like lifetimes ago, my goodness.
Right.
So he was in university at the time, and I think this was his kind of like senior project or some sort of school project or something like that. And he had the idea for this, and he wanted to create it as open source. I think he got a lot of like weird looks from his friends that he could charge for this or something like that, but he really wanted to go the open source. Which I think was probably the best thing to do. So he ended up creating a bunch of little command line tools first that did separate things, so like a command line tool that uploaded the app to the App Store, a command line tool that took screenshots, and they were all separate Ruby tools, and they each had their different code names. So uploading to the App Store was deliver, taking screenshots was called snapshot. Running the test was called scan. I think those were like some of the first three that were made. So they were all just like straight command line tools at first, and then eventually created the like what most people know today, which is like the custom script part of it, where you can like tie all these tools together, and you don't have to actually run each tool via in individual command lines. So Fastlane was then its own Ruby gem that had dependencies on all of these other like eight separate tools. It was kind of a disaster at first. Yeah, so he took this pretty big. It got real popular like beginning of 2015. At this time, during my consulting phase, I was doing a lot of mobile. I had a bunch of different clients, and a lot of my days were actually spent like submitting new builds to the App Store and taking screenshots and all this stuff. And I was really wanting a way to like automate all of that. So Orta tweeted or retweeted Felix's tweet about all this, and I was like, "This is amazing! This is what I wanted." So I hopped on. I tried some of the screenshot stuff. I found a bug. Submitted two PRs, and then right after that, Felix asked me to join the core contributor team. Which I was like, sure, I don't really know what that means, but I mean, this sounds cool and it's helpful to me, so I'll help. Ruby is what it is in. And by then, I had full, let's see, Ruby, I started doing Ruby in 2008, so I had like 6 years of experience in that. So I was a mobile dev, I had that kind of experience, so it kind of worked out pretty well. So I was on the core team for a while there when it was fully open source, Well, I mean, it still is open source, but it was fully on Felix's plate. But eventually, Twitter ended up acquiring Fastlane and Felix in that process. Fastlane and all of its tools were owned under Twitter's fabric,
Yeah, that's what it was,
which is
yeah.
where like Crashlytics and all that kind of stuff existed. And then I think it was it during that time. Well, eventually Google ended up buying Fabric from Twitter. So Fastlane then got moved over under Google's watch. And sometime in between there, I don't remember where it was exactly, everything got merged into one. So now, like, there's only one gem. It's one giant object now, which makes it a lot easier. But I think that happened in like 2017. And then at this time, I was still on the core team, but I was actually doing a lot of Fastlane consulting. So I had a lot of companies come to me for like helping to automate their stuff. So there was one company that was doing white labeled apps where they had like, which isn't really allowed in the App Store anymore,
Right.
but they had like hundreds of apps that were kind of the same thing in the App Store and Android as well. And it was taking them like 3 or 4 weeks to do manual builds of all of the apps for when a new build had to go out. So it was a small bug fix, just weeks of time. So I end up putting this all into one command that would do everything in about like 3 or 4 hours. And like, yeah, it was super fun, super fun.
Oh.
It did get messy when Apple cracked down on white labeled apps because each of these apps were under one app account, App Store developer account, but then they all had to get migrated off into individual App Store accounts. So
Right.
cert signing got super intense there, but that was also fun. So like during this time, I was doing a lot of Fastlane consulting. And then in 2018, Felix was working on, I think it was kind of public, a Fastlane CI within Google, which got shut down. But during that time, a lot of the Fastlane team in Google was focused on that. So I became lead maintainer to actually work on like Fastlane core issues and that kind of stuff. I was part-time for a while, and then I became full-time for about 2 2.5 years. I wasn't employed by Google. I was still independent, just maintaining. And then yeah, still lead maintainer. I don't work on it as much from like a core issue maintenance kind of thing that I do anymore because we do have a team that does help with that. But I'm still kind of in that lead role. So that's kind of the Fastlane story.
Wow. And how did you get paid if, so you weren't under Google's, well, I mean, did I say Google's? I was gonna say Google's watch, like you said, but yeah, how did you get paid if you were doing this full time?
So I was a contractor for a while, and then when that time ran out, I was a Google vendor.
Oh, I have never even heard of that. Google vendor?
Yeah, so I had to create a new LLC that Google ended up. What? Oh my goodness, hold on, there's music. This Google Home in here started playing music. I know there was a Google Home. It started playing Imagine Dragons. Well, that's fun. We can keep that in. That's fine.
Yeah, I couldn't even hear it, just a little gurgle.
Okay. Oh,
Yeah.
it was yelling at me, so I just unplugged it. I don't know what it does. I created a new LLC for Google to pay because they couldn't pay me individually. They had to go through an LLC, and it was a whole thing to set up.
Right.
And it was also a whole thing to also renew when contracts were up, which is why I also decided to kind of stop that process end of last year because it was not as easy as I want it to be. So I think I had more fun doing Fastlane for free, kind of.
Oh, just because of all that headache of like the
Yeah.
LLC and stuff. So was there a reason why they didn't hire you as a Google employee?
I probably couldn't pass the interview, to be honest.
But
I'm
it's,
not.
well, it's weird that they would have even needed that because you were already, you came with the project, you know? And they acquired it. So it's like,
I was. There was a bunch of people on the core team then, and not everybody worked at Google. A lot of people worked at other places. So like, I wasn't actually like acquired with the team, but like, I did become lead maintainer while Google owned it, which is kind of a weird role because you think somebody in Google would probably be better fit for that role. But I didn't really want to also work at Google. It's a little too big for me.
Yeah, me too.
Because I had enterprise experience in my internship, and it was too much. I mean, Google Enterprise is definitely different than like Midwest cubicle enterprise, but having my own consulting firm and having like I when I was there, we had most like 10 employees. Like, that was a good size for me. I like the small family kind of feel, but going somewhere big just wasn't really a choice for me. Plus, I think I'd have to move, and I didn't really want to move out of the Midwest.
Yeah, working somewhere like that. Yeah, once upon a time, I was like, yeah, let's try this
Yeah,
out, and you know.
it'd be cool, but
And yeah, I don't think so for me either. So anyway, well, that's cool. I've always found that really interesting how Fastlane just how it started, how it evolved, and all of a sudden where it is now, and how important it is to people's workflows and automating things. And
yes.
it's funny because if you get into a job ever, and you're the one responsible for cutting a release like every week or every 2 weeks, you quickly realize like how tedious. It's not like bad. It's just like, okay, you have to schedule time in your day. Like, okay, this will take this long. Gotta archive the project. I gotta wait. Gotta do this stuff. So you quickly realize,
If
okay,
you're on a vacation or
yeah.
something, or and like, yeah, like it is nice to get automated out because like everything is documented, scripted. So like, you are maybe losing yourself out of a job at some point, maybe, but it's also just a job that shouldn't be a job. Like, it should just work on its own. Like, it's better for the project, the team, and everybody for like everything to be as scripted out. As long as the scripting part is clean and not a disaster. So like, that's a job in itself. But yeah, it's kind of cool how big it became, and like, it being an industry standard is just kind of weird.
Yeah. Like if
And
you
then
say Fastlane, people, it's like a
people
household
mostly
name
know,
now. It is an iOS developer, you know? Okay, yeah, Fastlane. I was wondering, what was I wondering? Xcode Cloud. So I know it's very early days with Xcode Cloud, which if a listener doesn't know what Xcode Cloud is, when was that announced? Last year or 2 years
That
ago?
was it was actually the same year that StoreKit 2 was announced,
Okay.
which was 20
Was that 2020?
2021.
2020.
Wait, what year are we in now? We're in
I think
2020.
we're in 2022.
We're in 2022. It was 20. It was 21.
It was last
No,
year?
the 20.
I don't know. Either way, it was it's early
My
days
goodness.
still. But and it obviously can't do, you know, even a fraction of what Fastlane can do yet, I guess? Question mark? I don't know. What are your thoughts about how that might evolve and affect Fastlane, I
So I
guess?
actually gave a conference talk on Xcode Cloud for the remote edition of NS Spain last year. Last year, yes, last year, which was cool because when I was prepping the talk, I didn't even have Xcode Cloud access, so I was using somebody else's.
Well, that's funny.
But then a few days before, I actually got mine, which was nice. But like, it is actually it's actually really nice if you're only looking to upload builds automatically to Test Flight and App Store. Like, it is, which could be like the majority of what most people would want or need. So you don't have to build things and click the upload button. It does all that stuff for you. Signing should automatically work as well because Apple has all that So like I was using it in one of my indie apps, and like it was nice, easy. At the time it was also free, so like I was totally fine using it. I don't remember what the pricing structure is on it, but I think when I heard it, I think it kind of surprised me in how expensive it was. Like as an indie developer, I would almost rather not pay for it because I don't think it helps me out in a way where I'm saving that much time for the potential cost of it. I don't remember if the changing has priced, but I do think it's done nicely. And if your team is like Apple only, then it actually might be the way to go. But if you do have a team that is cross-platform, it might be best to still use a CI that can build both your iOS, Android, and other apps as well. That way you can still use the same automation scripts and stuff like that. Like everything, and it's still kind of more organized into one platform. But Fastlane does actually work on Xcode Cloud. You can install it in one of the free scripts, and then execute stuff in some of the post scripts. So my NS Spain talk does mention that at the time installing it was a little bit slow. There were some hacks to get it to and install faster. But I think in my example, I ended up building the or archiving building the app using Xcode Cloud, and then I think I sent the app over to S3 or App Center or something through a Fastlane script.
Interesting. I
It's not
didn't
clean.
realize.
It's not clean, but like it worked. So like if you do need to do something extra, renew, I don't know, renew push certs or do something weird, change. I can't remember if you could like edit things in the build beforehand. I think that was the thing that I saw like wasn't nice. So like if you wanted to like make a specific build for like dev or staging and like change an app icon or something on the fly before building, I don't think Xcode Cloud really allowed for that. So you kind of lost some customizability there. That might have changed now. But if you are doing anything more than just uploading to TestFlight or App Store, using Fastlane and something like Bitrise or something like that might be the way to go.
Yeah, that's some good information there. I'll have to watch your talk. That'll be fascinating. Huh, interesting. All right, well, let's move along here. Let's get to Deep Dish Swift, man. This
Yes.
is, I'm so excited. This was cool. So it's October 27th when you announced this, right? New conference alert. Yeah, I'm looking at the tweet. I know it's October
Yeah, I was like, I
27th.
don't even know.
I
Time
know.
is weird.
So right now we're at November 11th. So this is only a few weeks ago, a couple weeks ago. Anyway, I want to hear kind of what led you to this. I'm sure it was probably on your mind a little bit for a while. And so, yeah, tell us about how that came about, what led you to this, and we'll get into some more details after.
Yeah, so I have a iMessage group with a bunch of indie developers, and we always wanted to like start a conference that was kind of like indie focused, but that all it seemed kind of like a weird, like very specific focus to have. But I think we joked about starting one earlier this year or something like that. But it didn't really seem like a good time or a good place to do it. And there were other conferences at the time, like 360 iDev and things like that. So like I didn't want to like try and have competing conferences or anything, but I went to 360 iDev this past August. I ended up having to leave early. I gave my talk, or I arrived Sunday. I gave my talk Monday, and I flew out Tuesday morning. The conference lasted until Wednesday. So I got home and I was like all jazzed about like conferences, they're awesome, love them. I was like, I want to start one, but like just more from like pure excitement of like just coming from one. Since my, well, I guess going back a bit more, my like public speaking history is kind of weird slash almost a little bit dark, but I have a stutter. I've had a stutter since I was 6 years old. So like doing public speaking in school, speech classes, giving talks was a huge disaster. Like I could never speak fluently in talks like that. So like I hated public speaking. I just wanted to kind of like mainly like I turned very like introverted. Didn't like doing that kind of stuff. But when I was like 25, I was like, okay, this is annoying. Like I have information experience I want to share. I want to talk about it. So it took me almost 20 years to like actually like realize my stutter and like try and overcome it. So I started speaking at meetups around here to try and like ease into it. And then I started speaking in conferences remotely during the pandemic, and then in person conferences after, well, not after the pandemic because we're still in it, but after conferences started back up. So like this public speaking kind of thing is kind of this like cool like passion of mine now, because it's helped me not overcome my stutter because I still have it, but kind of like learn how to better use it and kind of fear it less. And try and like inspire other stutterers to also speak. So coming from 360, I did this 360 IDEV this year. It was, I kind of loved hanging with all of the iOS developer crowd again, but also like I do this passion for public speaking now, and I wanted to like keep using it in some way. So like maybe I'll start a conference in Chicago because there hasn't been one since 2019. Well, when I got back on Wednesday, I found out that 360 IDEV was stopping, which is heartbreaking because that's been a conference that's been going on for so long, and like it's one that people love so much. So like I already had the idea to start a conference, but it wasn't because 360 IDEV was closing its doors. It's because I just love this space so much.
Yeah, it was just so I was like, good well, timing. So
good timing, bad
that
circumstances.
They had to close. Yeah, bad circumstances, yeah. But good timing.
Yep. Yeah. So I was like, well, I thought about it. I'm like, there's no more U.S. conferences. Like I was looking at, there's a ton in Europe. Like you have Swift Leeds, iOS Dev UK, NS Spain, French Kit, Do iOS, which was in Amsterdam this past weekend. There's App DevCon, which is also in Amsterdam in the spring. There's two more that I'm missing. I think there's one in Poland, and I'm like, oh, and then you have Swiftable in Buenos Aires, like,
whoa.
And then iOS Singapore, like, I'm like, yeah. Okay, like, what, like, this isn't
Europe,
right.
Europe Twitter and like Europe iOS Dev is like that scene is huge, and then here,
yeah.
Like, you're
so I'm like,
nothing.
Okay. Yeah, I was like, this is not good. We need to keep this going. So, I was like, okay, we need to do this, I guess. But I was like, it needs to have a good name because Chicago Swift just sounds so bland. Like, I love Chicago, but I'm like, that name just it doesn't feel like a conference that I would want to go to. Like, New York conference, great, yeah, New York is cool, or like something SF, like, yeah. But like, so I was like, well, what makes Chicago unique? And I'm like, deep dish pizza. So we actually had deep dish pizza on Monday night in Denver before I left. So it was like on my mind.
And when was this again, the date?
This was August 27th, I think.
No, 2022. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that week I was like, okay, I kind of want to start it. And my wife, she came home from work and I'm like, I think I started a conference. And she's like, cool, how can I help? I'm like, awesome, this is a perfect fit. So like, she is a project executive in a architectural and modular construction firm. So she's not really into like the tech developer conference scene, but she is a conference speaker herself. So she kind of like knows what conferences all entail, what they mean, how to plan one, that kind of stuff. So she agreed help me with this crazy idea of planning one. So it's been something that we've been kind of doing together since August 27th. And it was rough to find a place. in Chicago to host one, because like I really want it to be like downtown Chicago in a loop, because it's very like iconic, but also the cost and traveling there is also rather difficult, because the airports aren't necessarily close to downtown. It takes me an hour and 15 minutes to drive downtown. So like I kind of wanted someplace a little more accessible, but like still kind of Chicago-y. So it's in a city that's real close to O'Hare Airport, which does have a lot of hotels. There are like things to walk to, but you can also take a train that's right there to go downtown if you want. So like it's still very Chicago-y, but not like Chicago downtown. But you can still go down there. So I wanted to make this event like as easy to get to for people flying in, driving, or training. And this location is kind of the best for all three, and cost should also be pretty okay as well. So that was like the location planning part. But then I also wanted to have like an indie aspect for this as well, because I am kind of in the indie developer scene. And I feel like indies make up a lot of the iOS Apple community. Like they're probably not celebrated enough for all the cool things that they do. So the first day of the conference is indie focused. It's only a half day of talks, but I currently have Curtis from Slopes is giving a talk. Malin and Kai are giving a combined talk, which should be cool. They work on Orbit, which is the time tracking invoicing software thing, and then Mercury Weather, which they just released. And then I have Emmanuel Grossever, I don't know if I say last names, from Card Pointers. And then there might be one or two more. But they're gonna give like very indie focused talks that are kind of inspiring, like from like a development standpoint, marketing standpoint. So kind of want to like celebrate indies on those 2 days. And then the next 2 days of, or sorry, the indies on that first day. And the next 2 days are very like Swift iOS, more kind of technical talks.
I'm so excited. I told him before we started recording, I told Josh that I'm just waiting on budget approval for my work so they can send me out there. So that's
I sure hope so.
May 2nd, 2023. No, April 30th through May 2nd, 2023.
Yeah. And
Chicago,
then yeah, so
Illinois,
that and then
United
for
States.
the and then for the speakers for like the tech talks, Peter Steinberger is actually giving the keynote,
Nice.
which he hasn't done a talk since PSPDF quit was acquired in 2019, 2020, whatever it was. It's going to be a very like inspirational talk about his like struggles with being like too deep, and burnout and stuff like that. So I'm super excited to have him. We have Ben Sherman from NSScreencast, Tunde, the YouTuber Ellen Shapiro, which done a bunch of talks recently. Daniela, Michaela, Paula, which is Curtis's wife, Mark Alpont, which is part of the Swift Core team, Ben Pruthi, who is actually a high school student. He's been giving talks at 360 iDev the past 2 years, and also gave the keynote at Do iOS in Amsterdam last week, this week. Super cool kid, love him. He's going to be like future iOS superstar kind of thing. And then Via, who is an apprentice at Big Nerd Ranch, and then also Paul Hudson. So the speakers are kind of stacked, and I'm super excited about it.
Those are some big names. Those are like, I'm so excited. And do you still have open slots for speakers, or are you all
Yeah,
filled
there's like
up, or how?
three. Yeah, like yeah, like three slots left. I kind of picked a bunch of speakers beforehand just to make sure, like, I kind of like had a good set before announcing the first year. And I feel like I could, with the amount of people that want to speak, I could add like four more days, but I don't think that's how it works.
Wow, I just keep saying I'm so excited, but I am so excited. I really hope I can make it there.
I sure
Anyway,
hope so too.
so really quick before we get into little details about the conference of like how you got that set up. the pricing, just so people know, there's early bird tickets that are available right now. And I know you
Yes.
tweeted like yesterday or
Just
the other.
over, yeah, just over half are sold.
Yeah, so it's like first come, first serve. Once they're out, then the price goes up $100, right? Cool. Nice. So, yeah, get those tickets while you can. Let's see. Yeah, the details of setting up a conference seems like it's to the outsider. They're probably thinking, oh, find a venue and invite some people. And it's like, no way. I know
That's what
it's
I thought
way
too. That's
more.
what I thought
No,
too.
no.
I was like, how hard can this be?
No way. I think there's a lot more that goes into it, and I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. And so yeah, it's definitely more than what I thought. And there's still more that comes up. But like I thought of it very high level and I keep like breaking it down further and further. So like the first part is like picking a date. Picking a date was actually really tough because all like the ideal date would be like fall time of the year, September, October, like summer vacations are over. It's after Dub Dub, after new iOS releases, so cool things to talk about. But like we said, the Europe dates are stacked in September and October. Like all of the French Kit iOS or French Kit and a Spain, both of those ones in the UK do iOS are all September, October, November. So having a North American one, I mean, in terms of attendees, probably not that big a deal, but in terms of speakers, bringing speakers from over there, like there's a lot of conflicting. So I was like, I kind of want to do it in a different time. So I was like, okay, like spring seems kind of cool, but I didn't want to be too close to Dub Dub. But also having it in Chicago, I didn't want it to also be like in the dead of winter because it is a really dark place here in February. So I was like, well, April seems kind of nice. It's like after Easter, maybe spring breaks, before Dub Dub, before school is out. And like the cool thing is April and May, you can experience all four seasons in Chicago in one day. And I think that's kind of fun. So like you could wake up to snow and then have like 70 degrees. So I think that's kind of a cool time. So I hope people enjoy that. Having it in downtown Chicago in the loop would be super nice because it is kind of like I said, iconic, like awesome, cool looking, but also it is kind of expensive and hard to find a hotel. Traveling there is also kind of hard for most people who don't live down there. Previous events in Chicago have been held in a village called Elk Grove, which is even further out west from the city, but there's like not many things walkable. You're pretty much just at the hotel. So I want to find a spot that was like easy travelable for a plane, train, car, and actually had things to like do outside of the event. So I think we found that. Hopefully it's nice. Hopefully it works out well. We'll find out. If not, we'll change it next year. But then like trying to find like the correct number of days for the conference along with the number of speakers, and then trying to like create a financial plan of how much I can afford to pay for travel costs, how many international speakers we can fly over. So trying to find a financial plan for this is so tough because like I didn't have any money to really start off with. So trying to find like sponsors to help initially fund stuff, and then trying to determine how many attendees will actually come, and like the price to charge, along with how much to pay for speakers, how many we can fly over from overseas, how many we can pay here, how long they're going to stay at the hotel, along with food costs and taxes and like AV equipment stuff, and how much all that costs. So I'm going to link this to you and you can put this in the show notes. But I found this really cool site that allows you to kind of map all of these calculations together. And then also like put a like number of like I think we're gonna get like between 100 or and 200 attendees to attend, and then this chart actually shows like what your profits will be. Along some like distribution. So like there's a lot of like uncertainties when planning this. So like just having a straight Excel spreadsheet without knowing like how many sponsors you're going to get, how many attendees you're going to get, how much things are going to exactly cost. I use this site to kind of help me like plan like at the worst we'll make almost nothing, but that's okay. But at the best we could make a decent amount and then use that to help plan the next year. So like there was a lot of time spent in this financial part to try and figure out like how much we can actually afford where and how much to charge for everything.
Oh wow. So you relied a lot on guesstimate. Is that what it's called?
Guesstimate,
Guesstimate.com. Cool.
yeah. It's actually open source, I think, which is cool too.
That's
But
cool. Oh, fitting. Yeah.
yeah, so that was a lot of it was to try and figure out exactly like financial situations, since I'm not really this isn't like a company backed event. It's pretty community kind of based. I have a bunch of awesome sponsors, which definitely helped. Yeah, that was I think probably a month or so that was trying to figure out exactly like what we can afford, where, and how everything kind of fits together.
That's a
Getting the
lot.
speakers was, yeah, this the speakers was probably the easiest part because everybody wanted to speak, I think. I think the hard part is trying to figure out who to actually choose and why. Because now like, I only have 3 spots left, but I want to pick like 20 more. But
Do you have a lot of submissions?
yes, yeah, I do. Yeah, I
Oh,
don't.
no.
I don't know how I'm going to go through them all and choose. So that's going to be tough.
Wow. So when you find a venue, what kind of things do you have? Like, so you walked into this building or wherever, and you just told them your idea. Like, hey, who I talked to about, having a big conference here. And like, what kind of things did you not expect that they like brought up when you like talked to them
Yeah,
about you?
so my wife actually created the RFP and sent it to a bunch of different hotels and locations and stuff, saying exactly like, this is our event name, this is what our event does, this is how big we want to do it, this is how many days, this is the date range, and just like spanned it out to a bunch of different hotels and different locations. And there was this one cool place. I was actually downtown Chicago. That would have been perfect. But like they charged like $150 per attendee per day. And I'm
Yeesh.
like, that doesn't even financially make sense. Like I can't make that work. So like a lot of the cool places were just like very like enterprise priced. And I'm like, that's not gonna work for this first year, probably wouldn't work any year, but like that's not the kind of event this is. So I wanted to find like a hotel, I think, that had like a nice conference space that could have like the classroom style like tables where you can have like your computer on and whatnot and like sit there, follow along. I kind of wanted a theater as well because I think those kind of look cool, but some of the hotels didn't respond, and I'm like, I don't want a hotel that doesn't respond on time because I'm like, I'm planning this event. I kind of want like timely responses from their departments and stuff like that. So that also kind of helped us decide which places to go. So the place that we ended up picking like responds instantly, which is awesome. They're super nice. Met with them, very helpful. Kind of geared some of the cost towards like more towards what we can afford because like we're not like a very like big corporate enterprise event. We're a community built thing. So like I don't have all the funds, but like they seemed excited to potentially have us this year and in the future as well. So trying to kind of play towards having our events there, not just now but in 2024, 2025, I think kind of helped out as well. So but you had to make sure like you could have space for the actual like conference talks or sponsor tables, spots to actually like hang out outside the event, different hotels nearby in case people didn't want to afford like the one where the event is being hosted at, parking, yeah, parking, train, plane. So trying to make sure like it's the least worst for everyone is kind of how you have to plan, which feels bad because I want the best for everyone, but that's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Man, there's a lot that goes into there. Into that planning, that
Yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And now at this point, what were you going to say? Sorry.
I'm hoping the event continues on after this year as
Yeah,
well.
yeah.
But like, if it becomes too stressful, then like, maybe not, because I do have other things that I am doing, and like, so like, yeah, like all work side projects, all that kind of stuff as well. But it's been a lot of fun so far.
That's cool. At this point, besides trying to figure out how to go through all those submissions and who to pick, what other things are you still working on and like doing? Or is it kind of all set up at this point? Or, yeah.
So it's really on like the marketing side right now, trying to get like the number of tickets sold the minimum number that we need. And then also trying to get like the ideal number, and then also maxing out would be amazing. So like that's kind of what we're trying to go for now, is trying to market, which is a little bit harder now with kind of Twitter burning to pieces, because like that was my community. That's how I kind of knew how to reach everyone. So there's a little bit stress around that. So that kind of throws a little bit wrench into how I'm trying to market the event, which actually might be better because now I'm less reliant on Twitter and trying to figure out these other communities, get other kind of groups of people. Maybe not just the Twitter tech scene, maybe like companies around the Chicago area that are more like construction based, enterprise based, that do have mobile teams. Be like, hey, we had this event that's going to be here. Maybe you guys want to join. And maybe these are people that like weren't in my Twitter sphere. So like trying to break out now and trying to figure out exactly how to market outside of Twitter and those kinds of things is kind of where I'm going right now.
Oof.
And then we also have like swag bag stuff and print materials and all that kind of stuff that we're slowly trying to get together as well.
Right. I think part of what you were mentioning when it was kind of cutting it out earlier, oh, maybe you repeated it again, but oh, it's like the kind of the things that the speakers actually get. So that's always kind of interesting because people who go to speak at conferences wonder, is that conference going to pay for travel? Or are they going to pay for XYZ? So, what kind of things is Deep Dish Swift providing and doing for those who are selected to speak?
Yeah, so for domestic speakers and international, we are going to try and pay their entire plane travel here. I do have kind of like a max cost set for domestic and international, just in case. But I think it does look like plane prices are actually going down a little bit, and flying to Chicago in April slash May is actually pretty reasonable for most. So that shouldn't be an issue. And then for speakers, we are going to pay their hotel then for 2 nights for the event. So from Sunday to Monday and Monday to Tuesday, like the whole like the nights spanning the event. International speakers get another day because of weird travel times. So, but most of the travel costs will be covered by us. But we do ask that if the speakers, companies do want to help out, that we will then show them as a sponsor if they can pay for their like plane or hotel or something like that. Because it is a big help, even though we are budgeting for that travel cost. Having the extra there just in case is does free up a lot of stress.
Yeah, I bet. You can use all the money you can get there for
Yes.
a conference like this. Wow. Well, man, we've talked about a lot of stuff and I could go on forever, I think. I think. Anyway, but anything else you wanted to talk about before we wrap things up?
I do have a newsletter every week,
Ooh, yeah.
that is Indie Dev Monday. Which goes out Mondays, majority of the time, sometimes Tuesdays. but it is indiedevmonday.com. We're on issue 121, I believe. I started it at the beginning of the pandemic because I needed something to look forward to every week. And I was getting into the indie developer scene there and realized that there's a lot of cool things. And it was kind of a selfish way for me to talk to a lot of other indie developers and like get to know them. So each week there is at least one indie developer that is interviewed about them, about their apps, that kind of stuff. I recently took a little break doing the interviews myself. So Chris Wu, who on Twitter is Museum Shuffle, did some interviews for me while I was out, but I'm starting them back up again here, and that's been a fun thing to do and a fun community to kind of have. So that's another place to follow me on if Twitter dies.
Cool. And on Twitter, until who knows? Anyway, you
Who
are
knows?
Josh,
Yeah.
yeah, at Josh D. Holtz,
Correct.
Holtz. So, wrap things
Yes.
up. We've got this is Josh Holtz. He's at Revenue Cat right now. He has all of this experience with Fastlane, the lead maintainer of it. He's got his Indie Dev Monday, yeah, newsletter, and Deep Dish Swift, this brand new Swift conference, which is really exciting. All this stuff is super exciting. You've got it. An exciting life. Exciting life.
It is exciting, exhausting, but I love all of it. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for taking the time to be here. This was way fun to
Thanks
talk
for
to you.
having me.
I really hope we can meet in person in May. And I
Yeah,
re or yeah,
for
because that
sure,
would
for
just
sure.
be really awesome. Anyway, thanks again, and we'll roll the drum machine, and we'll see you next time.